When did you go?
Open house.
Well, probably 90 or something.
Oh, wow.
DOS.
It's definitely pro-Israel.
It really is very, you know.
To their credit, you know, we visited some Palestinian.
And I would assume we're going to be scheduled for morning tonight.
Our guy told us, somebody's complaining about the entire, he said, you have all eternity.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
It's true. I mean, if you're going to be there, you might as well be busy, right?
Express and you're not trying to cut. Yeah, that's front and back, so it's one, should be plenty.
Great, as always, will you send me a word?
Yes, I'll make someone send an email now today.
Thanks so much.
I even thought about trying to be an overachiever and send it to you ahead of time, but I.
Oh, yeah, no, but then I wouldn't have had anything to say during the meeting, so I'm glad you didn't take too many steps.
Thank you.
Big in part during our last year and a half or so, maybe 2 years with them.
Did Michelle talk to you?
Yes, I've definitely heard from her and so forth. All right, let's convene our meeting, call ourselves to order. And if you want to do a quick roll call, that would be great.
Sure. Marcy Edelman.
Excused.
Michelle Alcedo.
Excused.
Michael Costa.
Excused.
Scott Heitzuka.
Here.
Ashley McCumber.
Here.
Perry Lane.
Here.
Kashik Roy.
Here.
And Molly Stein.
Here.
Very good. As I know members of the public are here, I will skip over the next item on the agenda, public comment. And today, you know, I have to admit to everyone here that I worked to pull this agenda together without really conferring with anyone. So it may be missing things, but ultimately, in a very simple way, I'm hoping that we can condense our meeting today, just touch base together, figure out who would like to present to the full task force in December and who would like to present in the full task force in January, because those are our two options. We have to present all of our recommendations within those two meetings. And what is, you know, the work that surrounds that to get there is really kind of the overarching goal I think we should kind of have together today. Do people kind of agree with that? And so I put this agenda thinking that, you know, this would lead us through that conversation. Also, earlier today, Tom, the other committee co-chairs, Bill and myself, were scheduled to meet with Kate Howard, the mayor's budget director, to get some feedback on kind of the budget process and if we bring forth recommendations, what's the best way to bring them forth in terms of them actually having a real chance of getting financed. And unfortunately, her life went took a curve, and she was not able to meet with us. But Jessica Kennard, who's the HSA analyst, was in the meeting, and we had a good conversation. And I just very quickly give you a few. We asked her, you know, some of the things we should be thinking of, and clearly these are pretty things you would expect. That, you know, that we need to make a real case about the real benefits of spending money for whatever we're recommending. Help them understand what barriers are going to be removed if we do so. Projecting out the cost, not only the initial cost, but whether or not these are ongoing costs, and potentially ideas from where you think the funding might need to come from. And clearly, you know, anything that you put forth should have an outcomes component. Like this, if we do this, then this will either happen or not happen, and we have better outcomes. And I think the other two things that I wrote down, and Tom jump in and add to it, you know, why doesn't this service and or action exist now? And two, can we leverage existing resources to create change? So those are kind of some big picture thoughts that I wrote down.
The leveraging thing that, you know, hit me in a big way. If one of the ideas was to say, well, let the general fund pay for this stuff. And as I talked about, the general fund is the fund of last resort. You know, everything else is, if we can get foundations or whatever to do it. Michael Cost had recommended at one point that we asked the the mayor's press office if they could help us with a campaign about the dementia issue. Educational thing. Mm-hmm. Things like that. The more stuff like that we can do, the stronger the whole thing's going to be.
Does anybody have any questions about that? It's kind of a more of an informal meeting, more than a formal meeting in the end.
She did agree. They will meet with us again before we're done. Yeah.
Is that absolutely. Okay, so moving on to number four on our agenda. If we could, I prepared this sheet just as a potential handout to Kate to say, here are the big bucket issues that our subcommittee is working on. And I just want to make sure that I've still captured all the buckets that are still out there. I may not have named them appropriately, but I think that it pretty much captures all the things that are still in our kind of sphere of consideration. One is, you know, I do think that the task force should really put a formal recommendation about the data collection efforts and having the city, wherever it collects demographic data, add LGBT status as an option for people so we can have some comparative data across any place where data is collected in the city. This is really the meeting that we had way back with the mayor's office and so forth, but I think it's still out there. I'll take the responsibility to work with Bill to make sure that whatever format that needs to be in, it gets there. But that was one. The other is cultural competence, and Koshik and Michelle are leading that. Let me just run down the list real quick. We have the mental health recommendation that you're going to present in December.
Sure.
And ready to present. We've already had you present to us, so it's fine, I assume, for him to present to the full task force on that. We've already, I wasn't there, unfortunately, to hear this, but I hear the dementia and Alzheimer's care went really well.
Yes.
And we still have out there some consideration to a veterans component or a recommendation around what's needed with LGBT veterans. That potentially could fold into the next one, which is what do we need to do to expand access to existing services. And maybe it needs to be separate, maybe it needs to be collapsed, I'm not sure. The next is this big bucket of aging and community. And I'm not sure where that is, honestly. And then I think today you guys wanted to present your ideas on the peer-to-peer support and volunteer models. And the last thing I kept out there, because of the issue of how unique our community is in having non-traditional caregivers, I think that still needs to be out there. Have I missed any big buckets? All right.
Okay. Just, I would say where we can combine, so for example, with LGBT veterans.
Yeah.
If we can, I met with Scott today around the cultural competency issues.
Yeah.
And he was really, not to overstate it, but he really wanted few recommendations with a lot of impact. Uh-huh. So if we can try it wherever we can as a group, so we have fewer recommendations, if we can put it up either veterans and also with caregiver support, if we can maybe put that in with 7 or 8, just a thought.
All right, so you're suggesting that we have a special component under cultural competence around serving LGBT veterans?
No, I'd say 5 goes under 6, maybe. Like
okay.
You suggest.
Yeah, they're collapsing.
Yeah, collapse 5 and 6.
Well, how about the dementia care and the mental health ones, too? Larger mental health ones.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys feel about that?
I don't know.
I mean, if it needs to come down to some, I mean, these things...
Sure.
Fairly logically fit together, I think. Although you know, we've done the dementia one and Alzheimer's, you know, already. But that's just a thought. If we throw too many things out here,
so yeah, I mean, falls under we could just present them to the full task force. At some point in time, the task force is going to have to kind of collapse all the committee's work, right? You know, so. I don't know, maybe I'm just not understanding, but I kind of see mental health really distinct and separate from dementia.
Yeah.
Because.
And DOS has a place for dementia, Alzheimer's, so wouldn't we kind of go under that wing rather than...
Yeah, that's what we recommended in this report.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry I missed your presentation.
It was terrific. Yeah.
But was it in line with what you presented here?
It was life-changing.
It was pretty much
it really
what
was.
You presented here, right?
But that's just me.
Okay.
It's nice that so too, right, in this night? Yeah, that's all.
All right. We've agreed that we could probably collapse the veterans issues under the expanding access to existing services.
Uh-huh. I mean,
all right, so does anybody disagree with that concept? All right. So that's good. Any other collapsing that people see?
Well, won't the data collection thing be part of, I mean, the recommendations coming out of a couple of the committees, won't it? So, I mean,
Well, okay.
I'm not sure. But I think it's an overall recommendation of the task force, right?
Yeah, I actually spoke to Bill with about half an hour ago about that because I wanted to see what parallels there might be between that and something we could do for cultural competence. And so what Bill's assessment was is essentially the task force has already made that recommendation. And yeah, I'm sure there's some gray area. What he said was is there was an option to have legislative action, but because the mayor's office was so supportive of it, that it's just kind of informally rolling out. Now that doesn't mean we as a task force feel that's enough, but that's kind of how he summed up where we are with that recommendation. I don't know if other people have different takes on that or where that's at.
Well, that meeting with the mayor's, with Steve Kahn, you know, like they just want to do it. They're not ordered.
That's what they, yeah.
You lost.
So this is probably about a year ago now, right? Almost, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Almost at the very beginning. Yeah, it was January last year, wasn't it?
When we met. The idea was that there's no collection right now of demographics around. And so we were thinking of making a task force recommendation, but then we met with Steve Kahva, and the mayor's office was very supportive of it and open to implementing it. Jump in here. And so that was kind of... This is where the gray area is, which is why I called Bill to say, was it actually a recommendation? Is it actually going to be a recommendation in the full task force? And he said it was actually a recommendation the full task force made. Informally, there's no legislative authority behind it, but the mayor's office is behind it.
If indeed they haven't done anything, I think it should be a part of the list.
That's where I stand. That's where I stand, because I think, you know, one can be philosophically in agreement and still do nothing. And if nothing else, you should document that it happened and that there's a consensus that this is important. You know, I think it would be a real error not to document as a task force that this is critically important. I mean, it's very much in line with HSS on a national level now collecting more data, leading the charge to do that. I mean, we started at this place, and to not acknowledge that this is still a big issue, I think, for me, it would be a miss, but that's just me.
I was thinking, looking at it like, is this from this committee, or is this a larger...
I put it up there because I didn't want it to not make it into the report, and I don't know that anybody else is particularly carrying that banner.
Housing a little bit, Tommy's.
I haven't heard that, so I mean, I'm just making sure. But I don't honestly. In the end, it's all of it. Doesn't matter what committee it comes out of. Frankly,
it's gonna be one.
Yeah, it's more. You know, these are working groups that are all going to eventually merge back together, and we're going to prioritize together. So, I'm not hearing a clear consensus of leaving it in our group's recommendations, or at least bringing up the issue to the full task force.
I withdraw my objection.
What was your objection?
I thought that could be the task force as a whole.
I think the task force as a whole should, actually.
Yeah.
Is that what you were saying, too? We're saying the same thing, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, I think we are saying the same thing. All right. Any other ideas of collapsing, and or does anyone feel strongly that some of these just need to go away?
What is number 7?
Yes.
Well, and this is the remember we had in our last committee meeting kind of a conversation I quite understood. What I was anticipating for me personally is what is unique to the LGBT community in the aging and community space that we need to call out. That to me is what this stands for, because there's a whole concept we could write books and produce documentaries on what aging community means in general to seniors and to anyone. But I'm particularly personally interested in, is there anything in that aging community space that isn't represented somewhere else that we should call out in this particular area? That's for me what I mean by that. And I don't think that we've outlined what are the specific LGBT specific aging and community issues.
Well, I think our number 8, peer-to-peer support and volunteer models, kind of fits under that.
Yep.
And that it seems like we need a program that illustrates that, and that we, you know, I mean, not in a generic way that we describe what it means to age in place, but that we illustrate it through a program that allows that concept to be supported. And that this peer-to-peer support volunteer models really, I think, has the capacity to, you know, express that.
Yeah, well, it's a component. I mean, in some ways, almost every recommendation the task force would make is an aging and community recommendation, right? I'm just wondering if there's, you know, there needs to, maybe this whole number seven is implied across.
Well, maybe we need to make sure that each of our pieces address that.
Yeah.
My take on our last meeting, correct, or whatever else people thought, it was kind of a circular conversation, was that Michael came to the conclusion that if this is kind of implicit in the other recommendations, it doesn't need to be called out on its own, mm-hmm. unless there's something in particular you're thinking about that's yep. not in these. And so I think the way I thought it was, what we have down to 7 and 8 was kind of on the same thing, and he was yep. okay with trying that.
Yeah.
But is there anything in particular that you think is not here that you have in mind?
Not specifically. I mean, you know, I'm just leaving it there just yep. to make sure that there isn't something that can fit, you know, that people haven't called out yet.
Okay.
So it may be that we just hold this as a theme and not call it out, but I don't know if that's what everybody else is thinking.
Perry, were you at the last meeting?
No, I wasn't.
You were at the last meeting.
I was at,
do you remember?
At the last meeting.
Yeah.
I was just trying to look over my notes. I think I kind of agree more with it as a theme and at all of our recommendations kind of address or look at that as a theme. That's what I'm leaning towards.
So it sounds as if that the number seven may be more thematic and making sure that it's incorporated across and not really, quote, something that needs to be, quote, presented as a separate item to the full task force as a regular recommendation from this committee, but a thematic thing to tie through all of our recommendations.
Yeah, right. I would agree with that.
I do think that number nine needs some more work. I feel pretty strongly that because we find ourselves in a non-traditional caregiver relationships, that we need to address that. And maybe it was addressed somewhat in as a piece of the dementia Alzheimer's.
Part of it, yeah.
Yeah, but don't you think that it's pronounced enough in our community that it needs something more needs to be said about it? And I don't know if the quote volunteer model is addressing that or not.
Well, I was going to suggest just for this conversation, not that we necessarily do it, but maybe see when we talk about number eight, because we have kind of a draft,
mm-hmm. yep.
to see if there's a way to incorporate it somewhat seamlessly into it.
Okay.
And maybe add a component onto what we were thinking of number eight. Uh-huh. What were you thinking?
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and I wanted to throw out there also is that it could possibly be incorporated on the mental health side of it also, mm-hmm. because, mm-hmm. you know, we partner with Access Institute, Open House does, and they provide a caregivers and self-care support group. So
yep.
whichever works, you know, I think it kind of goes in between both models.
Yeah.
So,
but there's a third component. There's both the emotional, mental support, which you're referring mm-hmm. to, and then there's the, quote, you know, peer support. But there's also, I think, an educational component that doesn't need to be missed. I mean, none of us know how to be caregivers. Mm-hmm. You learn this on the fly, right? You become navigators when you didn't expect to be navigators. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want that to be lost, too, because mm-hmm. I think so many people are really lost in this role, mm-hmm. completely lost. And so we need to make sure that we're enunciating that in some way.
Could we...
I know I'm lost a little bit, even with dealing with my own parents' issues. And if I'm lost, for goodness sakes, I mean, you know, what does that mean for someone who doesn't have the access to the information that I have? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I'm just wondering if there could be a way that we recommend building, you know, a relationship with a caregiver support entity, like, you know, Family Caregiver Alliance. I know we're not supposed mm-hmm. to mention names, but they have taken some stabs into this area, and that we build that their capacity to do more of that, because they're the experts on
yeah.
it.
Have they, do you know whether or not they've done specific stuff as it relates to the LGBT
community? Yeah, they have. They have, and they, I think they could do more.
And that recommendation, just out of curiosity, that recommendation would look like something more of, again, funding to support a program?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it would require more funding on their end. But there could be ways that they can call out better the services that they have in the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point that I was thinking today in this earlier meeting, that there really are multiple layers to all the issues that we're talking about. One is, does it exist and do we need to build it? Number two, does it exist and people don't know about it? And so that's really an information mm-hmm. campaign and a INR, information referral campaign. And so it's really, I think it's important to kind of understand the distinction. And you're right, if it exists, why not build that infrastructure?
Because they are the gold standard, yeah. And they do mm-hmm. support groups for LGBT caregivers.
Who would be the do you have a relationship there?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I used to a little bit more, but I could definitely get more involved in that.
All right, that would be great. That would be great. All right, so I think we have our buckets, and I just wanted to make sure that right now it appears, based on the conversation we're about to have on your recommendation and Scott's commitment to present, we have two things that we want to put on the agenda for December, which basically, by default, means everything else would be presented in January. That makes sense?
Yeah.
All right. So with that in mind, let's just move down the agenda and we'll come back to the that issue in just a second.
And I have a logistical question to bring up about the presentation.
We
want to
do the logistics. What's up?
Timing, as far as, do we have a set amount of time? Does Bill...
How did it work? I wasn't in the last meeting. I was a little bit at a loss how it played out.
I think Daniel had 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Yeah, I think...
Or that was a suggested
allocation. Next, what we should do is we should give people a heads up. I think Bill just kind of let it go free-flowing and maybe let people know that if it is 20 minutes, then, you know, give them a reminder 10 minutes through.
And that 20 minutes is presenting and answering questions or just presenting?
It assumes that the actual recommendations coming out of the committee are part of the package that goes out the Friday before. So people have a chance to read them.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did that happen?
It happened with the dementia one. I think we sent that out early.
You did, yeah.
Yeah.
But to discuss something complex and all that in a short period of time if you haven't read it already. So that's the idea. And I think, does it go out on Thursday or Friday?
If you just send it to Bill as soon as you have that, then, because
okay.
We normally work with Bill to develop the agenda, and then he'll just pass all that along to us.
Okay, so email.
Our meeting's not next week, the following week, right? The 10th.
Right.
It's the 10th.
Okay, so we have, so by end of next week would be good for you. Or as soon as possible.
Yeah, to Bill.
To Bill a week from this Friday.
Sure.
Or sooner if possible.
So it sounds as if 20 minutes is the target range for presenting and answering questions.
I thought we could have used more time. I mean, I thought the conversations we had were pretty good.
Yeah.
So I don't want to artificially...
Well, he's getting nervous, of course, like everything being shoved into January. And you have just a marathon meeting then.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So... Actually, Tommy or Daniel's went over the 20 considerably.
Quite a bit, especially. But I think that's because that's what I was saying is like he didn't know how he was doing, and so I think Bill said have a couple minutes left, and then So if we at least give people markers and let them know we really.
All right.
Want
so I think what we should do is ask for guidance, so you know going in how much time you have. All right. Very good.
I've got a question. Do we know who's going to present the other? Six.
It would be good for us to discuss that now. Expanded access to services that we also just collapsed LGBT veterans was a thing that Michael had put his name next to build. And so right now I'm assuming that Michael Costa will be in the end the person that brings everyone's ideas together to present for that one. We've already done dementia, mental health, we know Scott. We know that Kashik and Michelle are doing cultural competence, and question mark on where data collection lands. Kaushik and Molly are representing the peer-to-peer support model that we're going to talk about in just a second. And I would probably be willing to kind of work with Molly and represent the caregiver support item and make sure that we have something together for January.
Well, any way I can help with any of these.
All right, you want to do all?
You betcha.
All right.
Do you know who's gotten the family caregivers on?
I'm not going to share
this one. Scott and Kaushik and Michelle are presenting the next full task force meeting, right?
Yes.
Just curious.
Yeah.
Well, assuming that we're not against your presentation today.
That's
yet.
True. Yeah. You know better than that.
We're approaching this from a friendly point of view because we've had the discussion informally already. This is just formalizing that discussion.
Do you feel like Michelle will be available to present in December?
I'm sorry, are we talking, I think we should present emotional support, or what we're calling peer support in December.
And the competence is definitely January. Okay. She's definitely not going to be there in December.
Okay, yeah, I was concerned about that.
Yes, yeah. Definitely not prepared to do that. Okay. So did we assign something to everyone? Did we catch that? Okay, and I answered your question.
Yes, I did.
Okay. You want to just give us a quick update on cultural competence and where you are?
Actually, this might lead to, I'd love to hear some thoughts and guidance. So it was really interesting to hear the conversation about where we are with the data collection, because I thought we were going to have a general, well, I think all of us think we should have, which is a general task force, this needs to be done. So I met with Scott this morning talking about the cultural competence and gave him some context in terms of...
When you say Scott...
Oh, I apologize. Scott Wiener.
Okay, that's what I assume.
Supervisor Wiener. And how we first started talking about, well, there is no mechanism now in terms of anyone who receives city funding to have cultural competency around these issues. And we looked at DOS, and then the issue came up, well, why would we just look at DOS and other vendors who made all those kinds of things? And he seemed, not to put words in his mouth, obviously, but he seemed to be not only very open, but very enthusiastic to either using a legislative mechanism to make it citywide, either through the Board of Supervisors. And that's why I wanted to talk to Bill about what we did with the number one task force, or use the mayor's office somehow. But I even wonder if these are so huge and so broad and touch everything, the data collection and the cultural competency, if we even want to consider something where those two are even put together as a larger, we recommend that the Board of Supervisors, for the sake of illustration, you know, use a legislative mechanism where anyone receiving funds to support seniors in the city and county need to do this and need to do that.
I thought we were going to be recommending.
Okay. Because it just seems otherwise, and then we can kind of let them figure out if they want to stagger it or what have you. Otherwise, it seems like trying to figure out what DOS will want to do and how enthusiastic they are. And then when I talk to the public health department, like, well, we got to go through the commissioners. You know, we could try to tackle those two at first because they're the intuitive places to start. But especially with Scott sitting so positive about this being a citywide thing, my personal takeaway from my conversation with him is, if you guys think it's a good way to go, is to really try to maybe create something around citywide legislative action, or a mayor's conversation with the mayor's office around possibly data collection and cultural competency.
And I think that what's really interesting, when we had that departmental meeting with the Adult Protective Services folk, the intake unit, all the people at DOS, right?
Yeah.
When Daniel and I had this joint thing that Shireen pulled together, what became very clear is there really isn't a way to separate this out and say it's a DOS thing. That once you involve contracts, you've involved everyone.
Yeah.
You've involved the city attorney's office, you've involved. And so in some ways, you almost have to go the all-in route. I guess you could administratively, but if you're going to go policy-wise, then it's going to involve all of those entities kind of figuring it out. So.
And then, you know, the other question, I mean, we as in the subcommittee had this conversation, I think last meeting or the meeting before, is we don't know what the best way to train everyone is in terms of cost-effectiveness and quality and so forth. And maybe that's beyond what we would do. Maybe there needs to be some mechanism once the legislation is passed that determines, and we might want to make some predictions on budget or investment initially. So for example, if we were to require, and I'm just saying this hypothetically, that everyone needs in-person training, that's going to be a much more laborious and costly thing. Whereas I think you brought up, just do online training. Maybe the city puts an investment on online training around cultural competency and sensitivity to these issues and people just do it.
And I think that people need to decide, you know, how far we need to put our foot into the planning phase of this versus just the kind of here's the policy we think should be in place. I think we're better served to not write it to the nth degree, but to suggest all of the components that need to be there. So, you know, that there is an in-person training component that's extensive, there's a web component, there's video component, there's all kinds of different tools that need to be put in the toolkit. And I also think that it's really important to at least point to the models that are at least considered the best. And maybe the one we're using now is the best, I don't know. To me, I think leaving it nebulous allows people to kind of put a bow around something when it's not going to be very good. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. You know, I think as much as we can kind of shape it a little bit without kind of making it too laborious would be good. That's just my opinion.
And then do you think we should have numbers attached to that?
Mm-hmm.
So we think this will be an investment, for lack of a better phrase, the city needs to make at this level.
And maybe the first part is developing the program, and the second part is staffing and sustaining.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I do think that, and we have to ask people, what's the cost of culture shift?
Yeah.
And you look at you know, just something as small as IHSS. I mean, my God, that's huge. I mean, there's a lot of training to go on in there, and they already have a training component, so. What does it mean to add this as a component of that? As one example.
What do other people have thoughts?
I think that it doesn't happen unless there's accountability. And for to make change like this, I think we have to set some pretty strong standards and give ways that people can achieve on them, and particularly build it into organizations' ongoing culture, so that it's not something that, oh, we have to do it because they say it we have to satisfy that. It has to really ultimately come from within as an important value within organizations. And so that takes a little bit of push, and you know, to make that happen. And funding can be a really strong carrot to get that happening. I just don't see it happening any other way. I would love to see a person in charge in each organization who takes that on and really you know, owns it for the organization to. Remind the organization of what is at stake and create the culture, you know, build it from within. Like it's done with other programs.
I wonder, I mean, you know, I just went through it, I look at the kind of the mandate, the state mandate for sexual harassment training as a potential model. I mean, this is some pretty serious regulated stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a variety of components to it. But that being said, the two-hour web-based training that I sat in was not insurmountable, and or I felt like it was over the top. I thought it was pretty good, actually. I mean, as always, could be better, but it seemed to be doable. You know, it seemed to be easy enough to offer. To be doable and not something that someone would have to hide that they didn't. My question is, and we brought this up in the conversation this morning, is on the accountability side. Does it add bonus points when you go back to your funding, or does it strike you out if you're not compliant? Because that's really how you get people to move, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you make it an audit issue, right?
Yeah.
You get it written
into the
compliance audits to the controller's office.
Yeah.
So I think you're spot on about comparing it to sexual orientation training or sexual harassment training. I think if you can sort of set that as a sort of a bar and a standard, my guess is going to be in the group of stuff you're going to be talking about and asking for, this is going to be an easy one for people to associate with and to I think and to be supportive of, because it's really, you can sort of mainstream it along
yeah.
orientation gender harassment lines, and I think it's just, you know, out of the scope of all the policies they're going to hit. Because it doesn't seem, I think you'd have to dimension it for folks. Somebody's got to, you know, understand what the price tag is on top of it. But I think from a policy perspective, it's easy. I'm just wondering, you know, it's easy to talk to Scott, you know, about LGBT topics. Is there any intent to sort of fly this by any of the other suits before you?
That's a good question.
Present it.
A good question.
I
think we've been very sensitive to at least reporting back to our sponsoring supervisors on this task force. And the original sponsoring supervisors were, of course, Campos Wiener and Olagi at the time. And, of course, Christina, no longer on the supervisors. And I don't know that anybody else is officially signed on to, as I don't know how that works.
No, I don't either. The last week, I think I sent a flyer around about the meeting over at Shaharzab, and we were at this one that night. And they asked me at the end, would we bring our recommendations to them before they go to the board? And my answer was, well, I think the more support we get for these, the better. You know, same way that Marcy and I did with the Alzheimer's Association. I mean, it gives a credibility that it adds to the credibility of whatever is being said. So I think it's a courtesy thing, you know.
And the question is, at what point in time is it, as before you release your recommendations and finalize them, or is it in preparation for the hearing? I mean, I don't know.
I think they'd appreciate a little update. They'd get a great in-depth thing for most of them, but I think it should be before you go to the public.
You know, are you talking about the supervisors?
Yeah,
all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of the draft, like in
January. Well, you know, let's say we're all ready to go and the writing is good. Just to come over and say, here are the basic recommendations that are coming out, just for your information. Just a heads up so they're not surprised that it comes out.
This should be an update from a full task force.
Pardon?
And you're really not surprised when one of them says something
exactly.
that you are really not expecting to hear.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I honestly, if you use cultural confidence in the issue of training as and you try to put yourself out there as devil's advocate, why this training versus other cultural competency trainings? Why aren't we mandating, you know, certain ethnic community trainings and or you know, other trainings versus, you know, why the LGBT training?
I was actually going to ask, I don't know how we can find this out, but do we know, like, for example, I know in public health department, we have a cultural competence requirement. I'm assuming it's a department requirement. But do we know if the city has ever acted citywide regarding the topic of cultural competency? Or do you know how we can find that out? Would that be the city attorney's office?
Check. I can check.
Do you mind?
Sure.
That'd be awesome. Because if there's any precedent for this or if there isn't, I mean, I feel like the case could be made that even, to answer your question as a devil's advocate, is because the evidence shows that this is a real need, at least for the near future, that now that we have the data. And other folks might be able, you know, should be able to.
I think one of the ways in which people kind of indirectly get to the heart of competence is in asking people to talk about the skill sets and or background of their workers, and whether or not the workers reflect the populations that they serve. That's always something that's in every single contract or RFP, talking about the quote background and or, you know, competency and experiences of the management is always there. So there may be an implied part to this, but I'm not aware of any quote mandate to do diversity training.
There was a law in 2007, I think, that said that counties needed to do cultural competency training.
Mm-hmm.
Counties, and San Francisco did, you know, move in that direction, but there was nothing in there that, you know, really had any weight to what would happen if they didn't do it. But there was a legislative piece of legislation that moved that
on a state level.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it either, but I think you raise a good point, because if I were reading London correctly, I think those are questions that she would ask,
mm-hmm.
and I think they would be legitimate. And I also think it's better to get it out, to get a read, so we're not surprised. Because I know right now some of the ethnic organizations are fighting with unions about cultural competence and who they hire. You know, I think it's the path we should walk down, but we should also be aware of the landmines that are out there as we move along that path. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers to know all the ins and outs. But.
Well, part of it is moving to more of an understanding that really what is the standard this day is not cultural competence for a specific thing, but more of a broad-based training around cultural humility. Mm-hmm. And what we would tag on to that is that as part of that cultural humility training, that we help people understand what is unique about the LGBT population, that they should be in a constant state of learning. And what are the things that you can put in place that are markers that say this is an organization that expresses cultural humility and the ability to learn and serve new populations. That's kind of like the trend, and it really does kind of open the discussion beyond and says we're going to create communities that frankly, one, understand that they're never competent.
Right.
Honestly, you're never competent. You're always growing. You're always learning. You're always, starting from the place of where whomever you're serving is.
I think you're so right on to ask the question: how is this different than this deliverable someplace else? How is this different than what some other community could be asking for?
Yeah.
And again, I really think that the specific topic is the easiest of those groups for you to get past, because San Francisco has always set LGBT policy in front of almost everything else. It's because our community has been strong voiced, and this is who you are. You're the LGBT Seniors Policy Task Force. You're not another ethnicity policy task force, so it should be logical that you would ask for this piece of legislation. And it might be precedent setting, and everybody else might follow in and say, we too want a piece of this, but at least you're setting the standard, and I think that a lot of soups could buy into that. It sounds
point.
Right from a history standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a total parallel, but oftentimes, we're being tame, so I want to think about being diplomatic. When we have to go through the dance of getting funds from the city, you know, it's a really sad process for a lot of reasons, but one is you're pitting great causes versus great causes.
All the time.
Right, and so people are always like, you know, I think the HIV/AIDS organizations, we are very organized and very effective, and we're not saying others can't, they should also do that. So I think that's kind of what you're saying, which is any other group that feels they're being excluded, they should also do the same mechanism. We're not saying no one else should. But you're right, this is the task force to support this policy, and that's what we're saying.
It's also been, you know, a time in the past, I think 24 months, to really talk about cultural sensitivity around the LGBT community. You know, it gets better about bullying, anti-bullying legislation. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has really been driven from our community. So I think it really makes sense for us to step up and be the ones to put this on the table. And again, I think it will sound true to the ears of the people hearing it. And I think there are going to be a lot of other challenges around this that aren't around this cultural competency training. I think there's going to be a lot of services challenges.
Yeah.
So I think you're right to ask that question as the test for what we're putting up in front of for recommendations.
Good.
I think in an ideal world, if there was something ever passed citywide around cultural competency, then we can add the kind of nuance that you were suggesting, which is also to include or to make sure that this is addressed.
And you know, the last thing to possibly say about this is that any model that you develop which addresses people's knowledge and capacity to serve a population can be a model that could be adapted. And so we keep that in mind, that this is leading on this particular issue, but it really helps us address maybe a format that makes sense in other areas that need addressing as well. It's just kind of the reverse way of saying what you were saying.
And maybe we can document what has been done in the past, in terms of what Open House has done around cultural competency training and how it was largely, you know, voluntary with good intentions, but it really hasn't moved the dial far enough in terms of really pushing groups to really take this on as a value within their organization, and that we need a little bit more of an accountability in terms of legislation that would require.
Yeah, and I think what's really unique to our task force is what the aging component does to this discussion. I think any leader in any organization, youth-facing, who is not thinking about the LGBT issues and addressing that, is probably, you know, really burying their heads in the sand. On the other hand, it becomes very easy for someone in an aging organization to say, well, we don't need to worry about that.
We don't
right,
have,
because it's
we
sexuality,
don't have those
it's about sexuality, not identity. Yeah. And so there becomes the crust of the problem and why it's so urgent that we actually do competency training on this end of the spectrum of aging, because these are the folks who have really, they're not seeing the new wave of openness. They're not seeing, you know, what, you know, they haven't grown up in an environment of acceptance. And so that's why it's so pronounced and important to do it. So I think not. It's important not to lose that component of this training. What else in terms of?
So I was actually going to kind of make sure I got a feeling of the room correctly. So I think it'd be really helpful if you could find out if there's ever been anything citywide passed on the topic of cultural competency. But once we find that out, people do feel like we're open, not just open, but for seeing if we can have some kind of legislation recommendation. And do we feel like we should try to perhaps combine that with the data collection topic or keep them separate? Or we don't know yet.
I feel they're linked, but I also feel that, in other words, I think to be a culturally competent organization, you have to be open to allowing people to self-disclose their identity. I mean, that's part of competency, right? It's just saying we're welcome, we're affirming, you can know that you can be who you are at this place. And so I think they could be combined, but I also don't want to lose the fact that it isn't just offer a training and then everything's fixed.
Right.
Frankly, we have no way to compare what the real disparities are between general population senior and almost in many populations, but particularly LGBT seniors, and to be able to know where to align resources to make the most impact. So I'm not sure. I mean, you know,
and I don't even know if this is a conversation for us or if, because I have a feeling if we were to, at the next big meeting, we would ask folks, what do people think is happening with the data collection? We're going to get a lot of different answers, mm-hmm. kind of like we did here. So that might actually be a larger task force conversation too, in terms of what are we doing with data collection and do we want to link these two in some way or keep them separate as far as our recommendations go.
I think we should ask the full task force.
You know, part of my experience with doing some cultural humility training with Open House is that a component of that training is asking and educating service providers on how to ask that question. So I don't know if that's helpful. You know, there is definitely a link between the two in regards to the cultural competency or cultural humility training that Open House provides. So I get that question a lot from service providers. Well, okay, we understand the experiences of LGBT older adults. How do we ask that? You know, that seems to come up all the time.
Mm-hmm. It came up in two ways. One, I don't know, who were you at? You skipped out, I think, but we went to the Public Health Department's rollout last meeting of both their question, incorporating the question of sexual orientation and gender identity into all public health program. And so really the whole basis of that was, well, okay, great, we have the forms, we've got the language, now how do we train people?
Yeah.
You know, to be able to do this and what's the appropriate way to do it. And then they had the extra layer of HIPAA compliance into that, and then into that mix as well. So I do think that that's true. And the other example where what you say is so true is that in meeting with the DOS intake folk, they're going like, we're so ready to do this, but we don't feel competent to do this. We don't feel that we're sensitive enough, that we've been trained enough. We need help. And it was very clear that they would like to have more resources and training around this issue. So I think you're right. The argument can be made that you can't separate these two things.
Yeah.
You can't separate asking people for this information from the competence of being able to do so.
Okay. Before we move on, just one other question while I meant to ask you this earlier. When you were talking about accountability, were you thinking that having a legislative piece is not enough, that there has to be an accountability piece specifically within the legislative piece? Or not necessarily within the legislative piece, but just if the Board of Supervisors passing something, for example, is not really going towards what you're saying. Is that correct? There's be some other piece. Like, so what is the question? So what if people don't?
Well, if they're, I thought it was connected to contracts with the city.
Yeah.
That's the legislative piece, right? And that is accountability.
Okay, so you.
Yeah.
So if it's being passed on that level, that, okay.
Yes.
I would agree that you have to at least point to the need to establish accountability measures, whatever those may be. The other question I had, and was what about people who do business in and around the city but don't have direct contract with the city? So, I mean, you know, we might be able to impact all of the senior-facing organizations that do business and have direct contracts, whether it be DPH, whether it be HSA, whether it be DOS, whatever. But how do we make an impact, or can we make an impact with people like Kaiser and, you know, other big entities like that? I mean, do they have a contractual relationship with the city that would, under this legislation, require them to do this type of stuff? Or no? Are they removed and there's, you know, and I guess the other part of that question, thinking aloud, is that a step too far?
Managed
in other words,
you know, do you part of a business license process that you have to have a cultural competency test where that's right too far?
Well, no, I do feel like that creates a blowback that we probably don't want right now, but I wonder if there's a middle ground there of people who are kind of, I don't know how the contracts work, because the Kaiser must have agreements and contracts with the city, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm just using an example. I'm not trying to pick on them, but they're like the big bear in the room. Like, if they had this competency model for seniors, LGBT seniors, that would be a big step forward for about 40% of the seniors in the city.
I actually don't think Kaiser does.
I don't think so.
I think that you're talking about one. You're picking an example of someone who actually doesn't have, you know. But Anthem, you know, Sutter Health. There you go. So they all have contracts with the city.
Now that's a really important question. Is it really just those entities that are quote aligned with quote RFP processes? I don't know how
that
works.
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know.
And I feel like if the Board of Supervisors passes some type of legislation, it kind of falls through and it starts to snowball, and other agencies kind of look at that and kind of go, oh, well, you know, this is happening. You know, maybe this is something that we should be aware of. Maybe we should just start to follow that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. At some point in time, it would be really good to understand how we put together something that advances this effort without creating the poison pill type of, you know, thing that someone's going to line up and fight it. Because it seems like there would be a lot of energy and acceptance that this is a good thing, unless you put an onerous responsibility on private business and or on the nonprofit sector that is not paid for. But maybe we're not the policy people, we're the task force people, and we make the recommendations and we let them figure out the politics of it. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You're a smart guy, Tom. What should you do?
Just the example, there are religious organizations that stopped doing business with the city of San Francisco and it required that you offer domestic partner benefits.
Well, a really good example.
So that's where the line is drawn. You know, you can't really, you find a lot of pushback from supervisors when you try to push it to the line that really requires anyone doing business inside of San Francisco to comply with it. I think that it becomes pressure after that, a different type. Lobbying pressure, advocacy pressure from other groups, and also just the city saying, look, the law is, you contract with us, this is what. So that here's cutting off a huge funding stream for many corporations. And here's gonna, you know, it's a hard bullet to bite to step away from that watering bowl. So.
Final thoughts?
No, I'm excited to see. I mean, are the committee chairs going to be meeting before the next meeting? Do you know?
If we do, it'll be something around something like this meeting today, where we happen to be in the same room.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it'd be possible to maybe get a thinking again of how much time we'll have at the next big meeting. I think it's 2 hours. If we can have some kind of conversation started, for example, if all the committee chairs can come to an agreement, yes, we definitely want this to be a formal recommendation from the task force. If we know that ahead of time,
I hate to put a lot of pressure on you, but our chairman this morning enunciated that this particular recommendation was probably the most important recommendation of this task force,
right?
In terms of an anchor of change. And so my guess is that in the January meeting, where he's going to want to align a lot of time for this.
Right, but I think what we might be talking about two slightly different things. I think a lot of the context around this recommendation, especially around if it's a legislative one, in terms of what it looks like, will be also be determined on whether or not it's connected to the data collection or if there's current cultural competency things that have been passed. So what I'm not necessarily afraid of is at the next meeting, if the whole conversation is around what do we do with the data collection thing, I was just thinking if there's a way we can maybe head that off a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the subcommittee chairs kind of checked in and said, oh yeah, we just assume there's going to be a data collection recommendation.
Okay. All right, I'll cue that up with Bill and let him navigate that.
Yeah. Because as I said, when I spoke to Bill, I don't think he thinks it's going to be a formal recommendation of the task force, unless I misunderstood him, because he thinks it already happened.
Yeah, okay.
So
I'll bring it up, and I know that he listens to all these minutes, recordings. So one way or another, I'm sure it'll be back in the psyche there.
Yeah,
I thought you were kidding.
I thought you were kidding.
Oh. And I feel like possibly, because wasn't Marcy kind of involved in the data collection from the beginning, and what her input would be in regards to that and combining it with the cultural competency, maybe getting her input? Because I kind of thought the data collection was kind of a push from Marcy's.
I think it was a general consensus. I mean, okay. I think even at our first meeting, didn't we put a checkbox there and say, as a total group, we know this is a need. All right, I'm going to push this along, and on 6 and 7, as I mentioned in the beginning, I kind of put this agenda together on the fly. I think we've already addressed both of these items in the sense of this aligning, who's going to follow up on that. So with your permission, I am going to allow those to proceed offline unless someone has an objection. So the aging and community, we agreed, is more of a thematic approach across our work. And I'm not really sure where we want to go with the access to services expansion, expanding access to service. That's something Michael's leading. And since he's not here, I think it's probably best not to kind of have a big open discussion about it any further today. Anyone disagree with that, those two thoughts? That being said, we have something I didn't put on the agenda that Kochik and Molly would like to bring forward, and that is emotional and practical support for LGBT aging adults and a recommendation on that.
I would say this is number 8 on the agenda.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Does everyone have a copy?
I don't.
Thank you. Scott. Okay. Do you just want to take a few moments and take a look at it, read it, and then we can talk about it?
Sure. We can do that.
Okay.
Discuss.
conversation. I'm not sure how it'll take shape down the road, but I know the LGBT Advisory Committee for next year, one of their work groups is going to be working on this very issue, updating forms across city agencies.
Okay.
They're thinking about doing that. So if this is specific, maybe it could even be the work plan for the work group for next year.
Cool.
So, but this would mostly be like literally the administrative forms, right? Just updating that, make sure there's a check mark for DPH or HSA or something. Is that pretty much like what this recommendation is?
Yeah, basically saying yeah. Anywhere where we ask demographic data that we include LGBT stats, self-identification as a part of the demographic intake, and then that information is stored and used across city departments for evaluation.
For future use, yeah.
And you know, it is important to enunciate when and where that is. You know, you don't want, you know, someone going up to get a building permit.
Right, of course.
You know, totally. It's where that demographic data is used to aggregate city resources. All right, has everyone kind of read through that? You want to take
well, we, I mean, I don't. I think a lot of this we discussed the last time, but maybe mm-hmm. if there's initial questions or thoughts.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm actually very supportive of this. The only, and this is probably the same, I'm going to begin to sound like a broken record, but at least you know which record I'm playing. This particular proposal intimates that there's going to be one contract with one program director and a staff associated with that. And I think that's essential, but I also think that we need to take it a step forward because the capacity to develop this peer support model is almost instilled in almost many agencies across the city. And the question I have is that if, let's say, X organization becomes the expert on this, their job should not be to continue to build a kingdom of being the experts because they'll never be able to serve the whole city. Their job should be to be the leader, the thought leader, and the trainer leader or whatever, and then begin to work across the city to build the capacity. And so what I'm saying by that is that what this model assumes is that there's a competency that is imparted to peers and then that is spread to clients, etc. So what that takes is not only the ability to train and develop the competency, but the recruitment. A lot of recruitment that goes into that. And there are less multiple tiers of volunteer recruitment systems and training that already exist. And the question I have is that what can we do to both create the model and then share the model? That's kind of my point.
So do you think maybe essentially add some kind of trainer, the train the trainer component?
Well, and I also think that you have to let the funding flow. So an RFP, rather than being a singular contract, is one that also says, and then there's the subcontractors that can cover a portion of their volunteer time and or their effort to build peer leadership capacity within their organizations as well, understanding that they may not want to be the lead agency on something like this. It's really kind of pragmatically what I'm saying. And so let's say, for example, your organization was one that was selected for to run this model. Then Meals on Wheels and OnLock and self-help could develop components of this work within their work as well. But they probably would not want to own the model. You know, they wouldn't want to own all of the stuff that is structured here. But in order to have a broader impact, we should hold the practice, if that makes sense.
So would that lead organization do the training where the subgroups would do the care, meet with the volunteers that are doing the care navigation on an ongoing basis within their sphere of their community? I'm not sure. I mean,
It really is. I'm not trying to say decentralize. I'm just saying to multiply the effect. That's all I'm saying, is multiply the effect. And so the idea that a person in San Francisco is going to go to one source for a thing limits its impact. That's all I'm saying.
So I have a bunch of random comments around this. I'd start with
before, just real quick. Yeah. So do you think that should be? I mean, do you think that's the task force's? I agree. I think that's true. But is that something that might happen after thinking of next practical steps? For example, mm-hmm. RFP. Let's see that this is a 3-year RFP, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Is that something we look at in years 4 and 5, or do you think that's something we should include in this?
I almost feel like it should be a collaborative approach from the beginning. But that's just the way my mind works.
So it shouldn't. And so
maybe someone who actually knows how to do this would say that it can't work that way.
Okay. Do you think? I just want to make sure I'm responsive, or we're responsive to this. Is do you think that does the RFP prevent it from being collaborative, or do you think it needs to be spelled out?
I'm trying to get to the idea of what the model looks like when it's completely rolled out and having the broadest possible impact, and that's why I bring up this plus to this, is that I think that plussing it from the beginning, or at least laying it out in some form, is a good thing.
Okay.
That's all I'm trying to say.
So maybe we can add something that ideally what this will lead to.
But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I mean,
So there's just huge precedent around communities of choice between the LGBT community in San Francisco. I mean, we have replication of volunteer case coordination, peer support services, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call them, from your organization, your old organization, mm-hmm. and the Lion Martin, and AIDS Helplines, and you know, we replicate services, and people choose because they feel affinities.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea of creating one center to support the entire community is an idea which has proven not to work well for us, just no matter what you want to do. On the other side of that, DOS is very much about following a one-door central intake system that is a specialized. So I think that's
a good distinction.
You're absolutely right. The precedent is that we make choices about we make affinities and whatnot. If you try and make one organization own it, it's not going to be a successful model. It will ultimately fail. Someone will build a little kingdom, and half the people won't go to it because they don't feel an association with that organization for whatever reason it might be. It's not black, it's not Latino, it's not gay enough, it's not lesbian enough, whatever it might be. It's not transgender. We are millions of small communities. We don't successfully bond into one. That's just a reality. I think that linking the care coordination and the peer support is actually not going to be a successful conversation for you. I think the care coordination is a really big, huge topic right now, and it sounds like case management, and the minute you go there, you get into, we don't pay for case management. You have case management, and you have case management, and we have case management, and everybody's got case management, and somewhere along the line, there's going to be an attempt to reduce case management rather than continue to fund and build case management. So more it sounds like you're, and I also think this really sounds a lot like your original question of why you versus anybody else. This is we want to stop the replication and centralize case management and centralize it where, someplace probably in DOS is where we want to centralize it. So I think the peer support conversation is a huge, great topic, and I love your replication model. You and I were having this conversation. So there's a lot of really clear, not in San Francisco, but almost every place else in the universe, support around peer support as a medical model, and proving that it has medical validity as an intervention tool and quality of care. Lifelong in Berkeley won a huge grant from CMMS last year to do peer integration to the care coordination teams in the over 60 clinics. Berkeley Mental Health pays for a lot of senior wellness programs. They're using a model that is called Living Well, which is a people with disabilities model for community wellness. And so the transference of people with disabilities to the senior population, the peer support model has lots of, Living Well has a huge amount of Medicaid data that they can show. They reduce Medicaid costs over time through this peer support model. Something I think that when you go for evidence-based to look at a funding stream, there's a big piece of it right there. And the other two comments I think I had was, one was SF Village. So, there are lots of models around for how village support works, and there are lots of other people who are trying that sort of peer support. And the other one was the information that came out in the HIV planning presentation that I think we all got in the past week or so. There was a lot of stuff in that too about the importance of social networks and how that was one weak spot. So there's a lot of good data in there to pull up in the presentation. That DOS intake conversation for long-term support, I think, is a really important one, because you want them to be supportive of it, not telling them they're going to write another RFP for something that they already think they're doing. So it's got to plug in to that picture, I think, somehow, whatever you want to recommend.
I was thinking about the care navigators component that you were speaking of and the case management component. And from my experience as a person working with LGBT seniors, I see a definite need for expanded case management services. And I think that stems from a couple different places. One, knowing LGBT possibly specific and or friendly agencies, they tend to come to LGBT. We're naturally, you know, I think as humans kind of go to where we're comfortable. I don't know the part about the DOS and as far as kind of centralizing case management, but I think there is a need within the LGBT aging population to provide some type of care management and case management. Is it fundable? Will DOS fund something like that? I don't know the answer to that. So I see your perspective on that and what they might be trying to reduce the case management services. What I see on the front end is constant calls about referrals and case management and some type of intensive case management, because they see the organization as an organization, especially LGBT seniors, coming to an agency with, you know, that specializes with or that works specifically with LGBT seniors.
I absolutely agree.
Does that make sense?
The reality, the precedent is that we, you know, the community has its favorite organizations, mm-hmm. its favorite mm-hmm. counselors within organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, John Olson, my
well,
favorite counselor.
They have the competency, frankly.
And you go to where you're comfortable. Mm-hmm. You go to the person you feel comfortable with. I think in the long term, however, if you're going to argue cultural competency training requirements on one side, and then distribute the specialization out into organizations, someone's going to say that conflicts at some point down the road. You're paying to make everybody confident, and you're saying you have to have a specialized agency or specialized program. I think that tying the care coordination to the peer support, I mean, I think you can have a whole conversation around care coordination and its value and its importance, and could go pretty far with that. I think tying it to the volunteer support is just not necessarily, they're not necessarily required to be linked together. And together, they're not as strong an argument as either of them are separate. Just my.
I got a different sort of take, and I find it a fascinating discussion. And I'm in a learning mode on this one, because from my perspective, this, I'm not sure I would present a model, you know, in this level of specificity. You know, I almost think you want to highlight the principles so that they can use the principles to design. You're giving them the principles to design the model, but I would just assume that there would be a lot of pushback from adopting a model, and that's just my take.
It was funny as we were playing this out in this conversation, how I was kind of coming to, you know, what is the point of this? And the point of this is really that there have been and continue to be a need to expand supports for LGBT folks, and that peer support is a valuable and effective way, not just because it saves you money, but it also, frankly, in some ways is more effective than, quote, a paid case manager sometimes. You're building something a little bit value plus into this that is really getting to the heart of isolation and socialization and all those different things that you're trying to add to this. So I almost feel in some ways that there is a danger of going too far with the description. On the other hand, I mean, people might then not understand it. It's kind of really a tough call, I think.
But I like it, so let me acknowledge that. But I think you do that by laying out just as the guiding principles for the navigators, the guiding principles for the peer support, and let some organic process within the department, if you would, take all those things and put together, say, well, these are the best practices, this is another model, et cetera. But I don't know politically what's best, so that's why I'm just acknowledging.
Yeah.
you know.
Yeah. One of the first thoughts that come to my mind on that is, isn't that what gets kind of fleshed out the RFP process in the different ways that organizations might?
On some level, but I think this is almost it. You know, there isn't. I don't know where else you go. Once you get this framework, it locks you into this framework, and that's the piece that gives me pause. That's all I'm getting at. The principles are right and they're on target, but this is a specific model. And if I were in their position, to be locked into a framework would be troublesome. Would be problematic for me. And I'm working on some peer-to-peer supports, and I also think they got to look at where the money's going to come from. And if they aren't funding as much case management, and we know they're not, you know, that's another issue that they've got to grapple with. So while they think it might be good, how do we fund it?
And the other thing that, just because I included in my proposal about peer case management, so I think we're kind of overlapping within our proposals. So that was one of my original proposals, was the possibility of peer case management.
And is that staff? You foresee that being staff?
It's kind of the same. No, it's kind of a role of having a person, having peer volunteers helping with the case management. And again, similar to the navigators, pretty much the same. Yeah. So,
and just as an aside, just some of the peer model I like, but my argument to the health department on the peer side is you really need to give people jobs, you know, based on the ethnic community I serve. You know, it's like you're asking these folks to do a lot with no money, and that's wrong. And that's the fight that I have. Even though I agree that on some level it's effective, but I think they're just ripping people off, to be honest with you.
Oakland had a great program that they defunded that was about putting seniors back into peer jobs, and they were paying them stipends too. I don't remember what it was called.
So how would you make the distinction between the principles and the framework? Or what would this look like if it was focused more on the principles and not the framework to be locked in?
Yeah. I would probably take out references to model, if you will. But when you get to listing the care, navigation, and advocacy, and emotional practical support, just sort of highlight those things that they should be doing.
Okay.
You know?
So what would you take out then?
Give me a second.
Sure.
So I like the idea of proposing that the city fund a sort of, you know, a compass point training that is available broadly with some startup funds for nonprofits, any nonprofit who wants to apply to develop this sort of model in-house. And they give, you know, basically some small level, you know, half a position, half an FTE for a year funding or something, and then a training around how to do this all volunteer-wise. And, you know, at least that's what you want to accomplish, that sort of create a model, get it out there broad-based, let people come do the training, the city's paying for that training, sort of how to set one up. And, you know, it's a development opportunity, isn't it? You get to bring volunteers to your who associate with your organization, who become donors to your organization, as well as volunteers. You know, that's a big donor pool for your volunteers, right, in some instances. So it's an opportunity, I think, for nonprofits to actually, you know, create new donor relationships and
But to some degree, push back a little bit, most nonprofits who are matching volunteers in the field really put big, bright walls and lines around what they're to do. What this model suggests is that we're actually going to break that wall down, and we're going to train people to an extensive level, almost to the level that they could be considered staff. But they're peer leaders, and so it kind of bridges your conversation. Of course, I have 200 people doing friendly visiting and friendly shopping right now. We put clear guidelines, and of course, they break right through those rules every time. But we try to tell them that you're not supposed to be what this is prescribing. Your job is to, you know, provide emotional support and friendship and, you know, little tasks, but not to be the navigator of their life, replace their daughter they don't have, you know, all of that stuff. And this is not that.
Right.
Which is why probably having those volunteers connect them to a case manager, you know, a reputable source, and be that INR that you're talking about, yeah, for them on a certain, on a, you know, a control level. That's the type of boundary, rather than having them become the expert itself. Yeah. They're still a volunteer, right?
Yeah.
Hmm. So I think that's why, again, I'm keeping some boundaries between those two puddles is a good thing to do. But
it's tricky because we get into people getting into some very, like you mentioned, some deeper relationship. And with that, it's necessary to have some pretty strong training and some pretty strong support.
Particularly that internal staff support for the people who are out there putting themselves way out, honestly.
Yeah.
They're way out.
Yeah.
They have to have extensive support. This is not easy stuff to do. And you really have to, I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, is there other models that you can point to that you think do this well, that have navigated all the issues we're bringing about? I mean, or is this kind of emerging?
Another model as opposed to the peer support model?
No. An example of what's being proposed here and as this model. I mean, is there something that you could say, it's like this, and people,
That's actually, so this is actually based off of, and this goes back to meetings a few months ago, on emotional and practical support contracts that are supported by Ryan White,
mm-hmm,
and for folks with HIV. Mm-hmm. And so that's where a lot of this came from. And one of the reasons is, one is because of effectiveness, and two also because of cost effectiveness. It's the putting food aside, food's the most cost effective unit of service contract, putting food aside, it's the most cost effective Ryan White care contract that San Francisco has,
mm-hmm,
in terms of how much you get for the dollars,
yeah,
you put in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what you were talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
that's what, how, where is it
maybe
working?
Maybe that should be put in here. We talked about it a little bit offline.
There's another case for this in terms of another opportunity, because another thing we're trying to do is to make sure that as LGBT folks age, that they're engaged. And so what you would assume is that on the one end of the spectrum, you have people who are quite frail and isolated and don't have supports, who need supports. And somewhere in between that and young people are a lot of boomers coming of age with a lot of skills who could be trained up and give back and be, frankly, almost virtually cultural competent, you know, by doing it. So there's some real pluses to this. I mean, there's kind of like multiple reasons,
yeah,
to do this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes back to the question you brought up earlier, which is, I don't know, what this does or why we're doing this is, it really comes down to isolation and reducing,
yeah, yeah,
isolation and increasing community.
I have a couple of other comments really quickly. First, I want to say I think it's great. You know, I think this is a great proposal. One thing that kind of stands out to me, and something that you said earlier in regards to what Supervisor Wiener had mentioned, is, does this exist? And these programs do kind of exist. And I think it's important that if we move forward with this proposal, that we have some factual information that kind of says why we need to expand this program. You know,
does that get into territory that we want to go into as a task force?
Well, I mean, to some degree, though, in your number three statement, I was reading through the factual background of the,
mm-hmm,
problem. The statement here, nearly two-thirds are neither partner nor married, is what is really pronounced in our community. Why is isolation so pronounced? And this is that short sentence is why. And it's particularly true of this generation. They are, in many cases, not connected to their traditional family.
Mm-hmm.
And they're outliving their friends, particularly many of them that lived through the AIDS epidemic. But even those who didn't, you know, weren't directly impacted by HIV, and lesbians, et cetera, they're still aging with no support.
So I guess just to clarify from where I'm coming from, and I'm thinking about my proposal too.
So these programs do exist.
And
why is there a need to expand these programs? I mean, we have the factual background here, but are people coming and these programs are full? So are people coming to try to come to these friendly visitors program, and are we turning people away because our program's
but
turning people
we're,
away?
But I think we're saying this goes beyond friendly visitors.
Very much so.
Okay.
And I think we probably need to distinguish that, that this is sort of a higher level of support.
Okay.
And it seems that because it would take more training and it would take more ongoing support, that it would be hard to plant that into every organization that wanted to take it on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big responsibility to do it right, and to take care of people who are putting themselves in this position of really getting involved in somebody's life, and the boundary issues that come with that, and even loss. So that would be my question, is how it loses some of its cost effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
when you plant it all over town, though it would be the ideal scenario if our organizations could carry that weight of having this component. I just don't know how that could happen. That's why I said, would one organization, the lead organization, you know, provide the training
yeah.
component, you know, because then all the satellite groups could plug into that. But I still think those satellite groups need to do the support mechanism for their community, for their affinity group, because that's why people are wanting to be associated with their group.
It's like an affiliate or franchise model.
Exactly.
But on a sort of local level,
yeah.
like that, where you have somebody who's doing really the vetting and training at some quality control at some level, and branding,
yeah.
even
right.
if some program is branded out into the community, and you can mm-hmm. access it at any point in the community, sort of distributed
yeah.
mm-hmm.
reach.
If I could just add kind of like a high level interpretation of what I was hearing is, the EDs will, you know, volunteers are much more cost effective than staff doing everything, we know that, but there's a public perception that volunteers are free, and we know that's not the case
no.
either, right? So, especially with this kind of work, I think that's a key component, is that it saves money for the city or whoever compared to staff doing all the things that these volunteers would be doing, but the public perception or people who are not as involved in the details think it's, oh, volunteers equals free, and that's certainly not the case.
I think it's important, that's a really good point, but I think the important piece of that is having the support for the volunteers. And I don't know if we should take a conversation offline, because I feel like part of my recommendation is pretty similar
okay.
to your recommendation. So, because my recommendation clearly is calling for peer case management services, and, you know, I don't know how
that to me that. Sounds like the exact same thing.
Yeah,
I mean, because you're not going to have peer case managers out there without someone on a clinical team
supporting,
you know, kind of supporting them, and this is what this model is. All right, so what I'm hearing is a general consensus that this is a good thing, and a debate on how far to outline the model. so that begs the question. Do we want to present this at the December task force and have a broader discussion about it or not? And I would say, I mean, I'm fine with it personally moving forward, and others can, but I do think that we're going to have to help people understand how it works and, you know, what the benefit is.
Because I feel our models are exactly the same.
Okay.
So...
So putting aside that just for a
mm-hmm.
second,
yeah.
does anyone have any strong objection to this moving forward, or this kind of idea, whether it's yours or ours or combined, moving forward to the general?
I think we haven't fleshed it out clearly enough, given the feedback we've gotten today, in terms of how it can maneuver through this issue around working at the with different organizations. If this group is recommending this project, I don't think we've gotten through it very.
Is the group recommending that this recommendation needs to encompass how to get other organizations doing this as well? Because I didn't hear that.
I think it's just from my perspective, not necessarily. I can see how this can be considered possibly a pilot program to be, you know, in the outcome sections, to be replicated by other agencies out.
That and what I was trying to say, let me see if I can kind of pinpoint what I was trying to talk about. What I'm trying to say is that there is a philosophical agreement and programmatic models that engage lay people, or better, lack of a better word, in serving seniors across the city. Mm-hmm. You can look at it at PAWS, you can look at it at Meals on Wheels, you can look at it at the friendly visitor programs there. What this model suggests is that there is such a deep need in the LGBT community for connection and resourcing that this model could be a solution for that, which is the notion of taking all of this volunteer layperson capacity and bringing it to another level. Mm-hmm. And supporting that with people who know how to support that. I think, for me, I wasn't suggesting that we build 10 models across, I mean, 10 programs across the country, across the city. I was more suggesting that if you took the capacity that exists there and you're starting to pull leadership out of those friendly visitor programs, the people working, and you elevate, and maybe you send them over to the mothership. and saying, you know, they're the people who know how to help you become this peer leader. That's really what I'm talking about. So it's it could be replicated down the road. I think the other thing to build into this that makes it incredibly important is understanding this is about building community. Mm-hmm. There's a deep-seated desire, probably with everyone in this room, to get back to our community as we age and be a part of the solution. And this offers that. Mm-hmm. This absolutely offers that. And it also, on the opposite end, on solution base, it allows us in a vacuum of resources to create solutions that not only have good outcome but save us money.
Yeah. Well, and also it becomes really, in some ways, a caregiver training program because it's where people get their feet wet in learning what it means to be a caregiver. And that's what we saw with when we went through the HIV training, you know, as peer support. Some of us had never done it before, and then we learned how to do it, and then we could do it with our families when it needed to happen. And I think that this has the intergenerational component that connects us to the younger people in our and middle-aged people in our community. Which is very exciting that we could, you know, build across generations on that level. Yeah.
But you know, I think the discussion here, and from my perspective, you asked me how I would recast this, has given you the fodder that I think is necessary. This notion of caregiver training, intergenerational aspect, the social connections. I promote social capital, but it's the same stuff, sort of. We know that the social determinants of health sometimes have more of an effect than the medical diagnosis, and so the social capital, the social connections, all a part of it. And I think to answer your question directly about how I recast this, I would just use the evidence base and say, you know, for the peer navigator, the evidence base says blah-de-blah-de, and for the peer support groups, the evidence says blah-de-blah-de, you know. It may end up being the same thing, but it feels like it's a stronger case without promoting a specific model.
One of the things, Ashley, last time I suggested that the task force was struggling with an issue to sort of tentatively adopt something. Mm-hmm. You know, to say, okay, to bring it here, give whatever feedback you can, but it keeps moving it forward.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm sure I'm channeling Bill Ameren about bringing it forward in December, because
good.
January is already looking like a month-long meeting or something. So, and then whatever input comes along the way, whatever you guys can do between now and then, great. and then get more from it, tentatively approve it, and then...
I agree. I think this has become almost a pre-feedback session for the broader discussion. And I think that we've all extended really valuable additions to what you've brought forward. So as far as I'm concerned, I would say present it.
I agree.
Yeah. But be mindful that the deeper you go in the weeds, the more questions that'll bring up versus the consensus that this is a good conceptual framework, I think is really kind of the big message.
I would not underplay all the cost-benefit component of this. It's really significant, and that's just one of those conversations that it's very important to keep right on the table.
I visited 21 of the 29 joint House and Senate budget offices last Wednesday, and with Meals on Wheels Association of America. And everybody's going in right now, remove us from sequester, kill sequester, or so forth, so on. We walked in and we said, look, you guys figure out how you're going to fund the budget. We're going to tell you that we're part of the solution of why you have a budget problem. And I think this is very much in that plane. We have these significant problems in our community. And on the back end, we have people who need significant help. And we have people who want to help. This is a way to kind of move that forward.
Do we feel like the three of us should have a discussion offline?
I think, I mean, I don't know if this will happen, but I almost feel like there's potential that this can all meld into something.
Yeah, I agree.
One recommendation with a peer support component to it, potentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
Should
we plan on both presenting in December?
Can you resend? I'm sure I do too.
Yeah. Of my original proposal?
Yeah.
Because they're very similar.
I also offer maybe, that we frame that this is a natural extension of some of the good work that's being done from Ashanti to Open House and Meals on Wheels to, volunteer programs out at 30th Street. Mm-hmm. I mean, that what we're saying is this is a natural extension of that, and we need to continue to invest in those things as well. But this is also another natural progression and expansion of that work.
Good language. Sweet language.
It seems less, because we get so focused in on, because literally when you start reading it, you start reading money, right? And you're not reading value. And so let's flip it to value, and we can all sign on to it and then find out about what the money looks like later, right? All right. Does that bring us to a conclusion here? It's bedtime.
Can I ask if we can make our presentation earlier on the agenda in January, in December, if possible? Because I have to go to that San Francisco organizing project, which is that evening.
Would you be kind to make sure that between the two of us we bring up a couple of things to our task force chair? One, this whole question of whether or not the data collection is a component of cultural components or a separate issue, and where that would be represented. There's a second request that this particular group be able to present this kind of peer engagement model early in the agenda, and the third thing is direction on length of presentation and discussion.
Okay. Pretty exhausting list, but I'll do the best I can.
You have a full day before Thanksgiving, Tom.
I got to get the turkey.
I got to get the peer support around that.
All right. So here's a question: Have we established a December meeting for this committee?
Yes,
we did, but it's a late one.
It's
December 19th.
Christmas Eve, isn't it?
19th.
Oh, hold on.
There actually is one Christmas Eve, but that's been canceled. It's on the 19th.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
I won't.
Last thing.
Yeah, we did. Okay, so everyone, we're going to keep that as our next meeting. And this is after the task force meeting, of course.
Which is on the 10th.
But before the task force meeting in January. Okay. Then is there any other announcements or public comment?
So I'm sorry, December 19th is
is the next committee meeting.
Okay. 4 to 6 here.
Yeah. And that would be the time where if any people want to present in January, they have to be aware that they need to kind of have at least a frame of what Kosheek and Molly handed out today for us to discuss.
Yeah, I'm available. Sure.
Yeah.
After this meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So there being no other comment or discussion or announcements, I will call this meeting adjourned.